The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the kind of meditation practices that we offer here, there's kind of two different threads almost of the practice, and sometimes these two threads can seem to be in conflict with each other. One thread is the thread of mindfulness, where we are interested and curious about meeting whatever's happening in the present moment. Just, oh, this is what's arising. Body sensations, sound, emotion, sometimes challenging emotion or beautiful emotion. And so really the cultivation of mindfulness, ultimately the cultivation of mindfulness, develops the capacity and the stability to meet whatever's happening. And yet that capacity of mindfulness to be able to hold whatever's happening. You know, when I first started practicing, there was a lot of anger. A lot of anger that, you know, the anger was a really go-to strategy for me. Aversion and anger were the strategies that my mind had learned how to navigate the world with a feeling of kind of safety. And so when I began meditating, I saw the anger, a lot of it. And it was, sometimes it was overwhelming, and it was not easy to simply, oh, this is anger, I can be with this. I would get caught by it, I'd get pulled away into it. And so the other thread of practices that we offer often are these kind of skillful tools for helping us be balanced when something is challenging. And the threads of learning how to turn away from something that's difficult or cultivate another kind of state of mind. Sometimes there's a practice of cultivating kindness when we are kind of caught by anger. We might try to remind ourselves, you know, this person too was a child at one point, or maybe something to kind of, with wisdom, normalize it. Maybe I don't understand the entirety of the situation of why that person did that thing. And so we may at times in our practice almost try to counter the difficulties with something. And so sometimes the question comes up, and I would say, well, what I'd say is the first kind of set of tools, just the mindfulness, cultivating the mindfulness, that's in the realm of right mindfulness, just being aware of what's happening while it's happening in the present moment with some degree of balance of mind and stability. And the other, the tools for navigating challenge, the tools for recognizing, oh, this is a challenging mind state. It's kind of leading me down the garden path of anger or frustration or pride or greed, whatever it is. It's kind of pulling me along with it. Maybe I should see if I can let go of that and turn my attention to something else. And so this is in the realm of what we could call right effort. Effort to let go of states of greed, aversion, delusion, confusion when they arise. Effort to avoid states of greed, aversion, delusion from arising. Cultivating wholesome states, cultivating states of love, of kindness, of compassion, of equanimity, of balance of mind. And encouraging those when they are present. These are kind of the kind of a general statement of the direction that we'd want to go with the tools if we're not just able to be simply aware of what's happening in the present moment. And so, you know, sometimes I've met with people who anytime something challenging arises is immediately applying the Band-Aid of, oh, I better bring some metta in, better bring some loving kindness in. My anger's arising, don't want to be there, better turn the attention away from that. And it's almost like they're not giving themselves enough kind of credit, or giving their practice enough credit for maybe being able to recognize sometimes, oh, this is anger, this anger hurts, this is what anger feels like. So sometimes people have that kind of orientation, kind of orienting more towards the stay away from those states of greed, aversion, delusion. And other times people end up with the kind of mindset of, if I'm not able to just be with this thing, you know, whatever it is, if I notice this difficult state of mind and I'm doing something to counteract it, that means I'm clinging to wanting it to not be there. It means that I have aversion to the state and I'm doing something to get rid of it. And so this is kind of the koan or the paradox in a way of the practice and learning. You know, how do we know when we can just be with something and when we might need to apply some tools? So this really is kind of a question, or when can we just be aware? When can we bring just this mindfulness of, oh, this is what's happening right now? And when do we need to bring in some tools to kind of redirect or shift the way the mind is working? So the Buddha spoke about this, gave an analogy about this, that there are different conditions at different times and different times that we need to do different things. So he gave the analogy of a cowherd. The analogy is of a person who's watching the cows in the field. And certain conditions, certain times of the year, it's said that at certain times of the year, at the end of the rainy season, there's all the crops are growing. And the cowherd has to be careful with the cows to really watch out for them and make sure that they don't wander into the crops. So it says, just as in the last month of rains, in the autumn season when the crops are ripening, a cowherd would look after the cows. They would tap and poke and check and curb them with the stick on this side and that. Why? Because they foresee imprisonment or fine arising if they let the cows wander into the crops. And then he compares that to his own practice. He said, sometimes I saw there were unskillful qualities in the mind that caused greed, aversion, and delusion, and saw that there needed to be some action to avoid the mind going there. So just like you might at times of the year take active action with the cows. Sometimes, he said, in the mind, I needed to take active action to not have the mind go into those unskillful states. And then he says, and sometimes at the end of the hot season, after all the crops have been picked and there's no crops left in the field, then the cowherd can simply rest under the shade of a tree and keep himself aware of the cows and not have to continually prod or poke them with the stick. And he said, in the same way, there were times in the practice when I simply could be aware, oh, these mental qualities are arising. And so that he's pointing to different conditions at different times. So that different conditions, you know, that sometimes we think, I certainly had this sense at a certain point, that the conditions were simply about my skill in meditation. It's like I learn how to meditate, I learn how to watch certain things, and if I've learned how to be with anger in a certain way, then I should always be able to be with anger in that way once I've learned it. It's kind of like we think that meditating is like, you know, that we can just do the same thing we've done before. And sometimes that happens, but there's also so many different conditions that kind of feed into our capacities. Something as simple as how long it's been since we've eaten, or what the weather is like, or how much sleep we got can affect our capacity to meet experience. And so it's not something to judge in our minds. If there are times when we see, you know, like so many times I would see something arise in my mind and be like, wow, yesterday I was able to be with this. This was often on retreat. You know, yesterday I was able to be with this. Today I'm not, you know, I'm failing. I've lost the practice. It's like, well, no, there's different conditions today. Different situations in the body. You know, we can wake up with a headache or something that shifts the conditions of our system. And so at different times, we may need to bring in some tools. And at other times, we may be able to simply be aware and be mindful. Oh, this is what's happening right now. So this using something to help us let go of a difficulty. And this we could think of this almost as this is the kind of way that tools work. Recognizing. Somebody came up to me the other day and said, you know, I'm aware of the experience, and when I begin to see a certain habit of mind, and I'm seeing this kind of habit of frustration or whatever it was that they were pointing to, this habit of frustration, I see it and I notice it, and then I realize or I've recognized that I can shift the mind out of that, that I don't have to stay stuck in it, that I can shift out of it and change the direction of the mind. And that person said, but is that like clinging? Does it mean that I have aversion to that frustration that I do that? And there's not a one answer to that. So what I ask is, does it feel like it's helpful? Does it feel like the mind is more able to be present, to be at ease, to be balanced, if you do that? If you shift the mind in that direction? And if that's the case, if it does feel helpful, then for that time, that is a useful practice. That's helpful. So the Buddha used this phrase that I like, and it resonates for me. He uses this phrase, by relying on this, abandon that. By relying on this, let go of that. And in a way, that's exactly what this person was doing. By relying on a capacity that she knew she could shift the thoughts in her mind. You know, sometimes that's a tool we can use. We can recognizing our mind is caught in a story around frustration. We can decide, okay, I'm going to let go of those thoughts and put different thoughts into my mind. Think different thoughts. That strategy is kind of like when that's useful. That's relying on a technique, relying on a tool to help the mind let go of something. To help the mind let go of something that's more difficult. There may be some clinging there. There might be a little bit of identification, or there might be some aversion even to that difficult state. Maybe there is. Certainly for me, I recognized early in my practice that I had all of this. I think I mentioned this last week. And all of this self-hatred and anger and aversion. And as I learned how to meditate, I began to recognize that I could do something. I could settle the mind. I could calm the mind down. And I found myself in some ways beginning to get attached to the meditation. I could see that the mind was like, oh, this is so much more relieving. I can take a break from all of this stuff. And there was aversion to the self-hatred, and there was aversion to the anger and the those difficult states. There was some aversion to that. And there was a little bit of the kind of like, oh yeah, this is more pleasant. So there was some kind of orienting to what was more pleasant. And yet, you know, in that process, so I could see that there was a little bit of attachment to the practice and to those tools that were helping me let go of something that was so painful. And yet, you know, the difference, let's say the difference between being caught in that self-hatred and caught in that anger and just letting, you know, acting out of those and having the action out of those, let those ruts dig more deep into my mind, and this kind of picking up of something different. It's like the difference between those two. It's like in some ways it's like, well, rely on, yeah, identifying with being a meditator, or rely on identifying with, or rely on attachment to some kind of calm that happens when I turn my attention to the breath or to the body for a little while instead of getting caught in those thoughts. By relying on that, the mind could begin to let go of the anger and the aversion. So this is kind of that, by relying on this or depending on something, the mind can begin to let go of something else. And yet, you know, what seems to happen at some point, you know, at some point we might begin to recognize that there is some clinging there, but it's like we don't avoid doing this helpful thing just because there's some clinging there when it's helping us let go of something that's even more destructive in our minds. And so that's this, to me, there's this kind of, it's like a stair step kind of thing. There's a kind of a set of patterns that are kind of taking us into our kind of habitual ways of navigating that often can be based in greed, aversion, delusion. And we begin to learn some tools that help us to step out of those. If I were to say I should never do something that has clinging, then I would never have gotten through that process. So it's kind of like, okay, I'm willing to let myself cling to something a little bit here in order to let go of this. So by relying on this, abandon that. By relying on this, abandon that. At some point, what I did discover is, it's kind of like, I don't remember if I mentioned this last week, but because there was something from that I said last week that inspired me to give this talk. So there is a kind of a through line between last week's talk and this week's talk. There's kind of layers of struggle in our minds. And when we come into our practice, often what we're first meeting is the big kinds of ways in which we're caught and stuck. For me, that was this anger and aversion and self-hatred. And as I practiced, as I began to learn how to settle the mind, learn how to stay with the body for a little while, recognize that the thoughts would take me into the those patterns of self-hatred, and like, oh, maybe I don't have to follow those thoughts. So as I began to do that over and over again, with some attachment to being a meditator, it's like that whole, like the whole outer layer of suffering, that whole outer layer of patterns of conditioning around anger and self-hatred and aversion, that all began to get weaker and softer, began to fall away. And then, as that kind of layer began to release, as that, you know, sometimes what happens is that we kind of lose a whole section of our ways that we've navigated with greed, aversion, and delusion. And it feels pretty good for a while. It's like, oh, yeah, wow, I'm actually pretty happy and content. There's a lot of contentment going on. And then what seems to happen sometimes is that as the mind kind of adjusts to this new level of contentment, then we begin to recognize the ways in which the mind is actually tight or constricted or holding around these tools. And so there was a particular point in my practice when kind of the identification with being a meditator, or actually a big piece of it was around how the mind investigated. So this mind has a kind of a investigative. It investigates easily, this mind. And that was something that the mind kind of picked up and identified around. It's like, oh, I can do this. I'm a good investigator, and I can look at just about anything and see all the pieces and parts of it. And that was really supportive while the investigation was, you know, helping the mind to let go of this self-hatred and greed and aversion. And then at some point, as all of the bigger layers of suffering fell away, there was kind of this, I'm a good investigator. That began to be experienced as painful. It began, the feeling of, I can do this well, there was a kind of a feeling of the pride, of the arrogance there, began to be felt as painful. And so this is the point now. So by relying on that investigation, I was able to abandon something very, very painful. And as that was abandoned, then, now it's not that the investigation needed to be abandoned, but the identification and the attachment to the investigation, that needed to be seen. The kind of the suffering around that part needed to be seen. And so then there was a whole different, you know, kind of process that began to unfold. And part of that process was around, okay, what does it feel like to be so proud of being a good investigator? What is that like? So there's a place where in the teachings, and last week I talked about this analogy of crossing the flood, that the flood of unwholesome states, of kind of our habits and patterns around greed, aversion, delusion, that's kind of sweeping us away. And I talked about the process by which we can cross the flood. One analogy that the Buddha used in terms of how he said he crossed the flood. But he had another analogy where he used a simile about a raft crossing a flood. And he said that the raft, you know, we build the raft out of sticks and twine, and we put that all together, and we use that raft to cross the flood. And he equated that raft with the tools of the Eightfold Path. He said, you know, it's like we need to put together the Eightfold Path with our experience. So it's a dynamic, active process. And so we use the Eightfold Path with our direct experience, and that builds our raft. And so we cross over the flood by having this raft. Now, while you're crossing a flood, while you're crossing on a raft, you've got to make effort. You know, you have to actually, get your hands in the water, get your feet in the water. You're gonna be navigating that flood. And, you know, the image of a raft, it's like, you know, there's holes in that raft. It's not like you've built this amazing yacht to cross the flood. You got these sticks and twigs, put this raft together. Maybe it's like barely holding together. And you're crossing this flood. You're getting wet. It's not a clean process, crossing the flood. And so you need to hold on. You know, there may be times when you actually have to really hold on to that raft so that you don't fall off, or that, you know, actually it doesn't fall apart while you're crossing. And so there's a way in which we have to, like, really, like, by relying on that raft, we depend on that raft to cross the flood, to cross over or navigate the greed, aversion, and delusion, to navigate the anger and frustration and hatred and confusion and pride and arrogance and all of these states of mind that make us feel tight and create this suffering and struggle in our hearts. So we have to hold on to the raft. And so this is that, by relying on this, we are in the process of abandoning that in the crossing the flood on that raft. But then at the end of that analogy with the raft, the Buddha says, so once you've crossed over, once you've gotten to the other side of the river, the other side of the flood, he asked his monks, he said, so is it useful at that point to pick up the raft and put it on your head and walk around, carry it around with you wherever you go? And they said, no, that's not useful. You've made use of the raft. Now you can put it down. You can let it go. You can let it set it adrift or just leave it on dry land. You don't need to hold on to it anymore. And he said, likewise, we should let go of holding on to wholesome states, even. How much more so we should let go of holding on to unwholesome states. And he said, the Dharma is like that raft. It's for use of crossing over, but not for the purposes of clinging, not for the purposes of holding on to and kind of reifying it, making it a thing. Buddhism is the only way, whatever. You know, so it is a dynamic set of processes that are useful for us to meet our experience and transform it, but not so useful for holding on to, identifying with, feeling like this is who I am, or kind of like I was identified or clinging to that investigation. Investigation itself is a wholesome state. It's talked about in some of the various lists form of the what is investigation. It's kind of pointed to as a wholesome quality. But the clinging to that as being, I am a good investigator, that was where the suffering was. That was suffering. And so, you know, we can't let go of these wholesome qualities too soon. You know, we may need to hold on to them. We need to rely on them probably for quite a while. And so one of the things I think that can be useful for us in terms of navigating this question that I started out with in the talk, the question of how do I know? How do I know when to be active in applying tools and when to simply be aware? There's a couple pieces I'll bring in. One is, it's useful to give yourself a chance to see if the mindfulness can meet whatever is happening. In working with people, I often see that there is this kind of almost like fear of these difficult states that they feel like if they're even bringing mindfulness to it, it means like those states are getting worse. One student said, if as long as there's aversion in the mind, it means the aversion is being cultivated. And that's just not true, actually. Because when there is a kind of, there's something that happens when we are able to be aware of something challenging. So if we're able to know, oh, this is aversion and this is what it feels like. This is self-hatred, this is what it feels like. When we're able to know that, it's kind of like the, I sometimes use this analogy of gears. When we're engaged with a particular habit or pattern, and the habit or pattern is, so if anger is arising and we are buying into that anger, it's like the gears are engaged. We have our foot on the accelerator, we're heading down the freeway with that pattern, and that is what is, that does dig that groove more deeply. That does cultivate that pattern. But when we can know, oh, this is the experience of anger, this is what it feels like to be a human being, that is experiencing anger or aversion or frustration or confusion, whatever the pattern is, it's like what happens with that awareness is that the gears are disengaged. In terms of an analogy of a car, it's like putting a car into neutral. So that practice of being aware, when the mind can simply recognize, oh, this is what's happening, it's like the mind is in neutral with the pattern. And just as with the car, when we put a car into neutral, it will slow down. If the gears are engaged and we have our foot on the accelerator, the car is going to keep going and may speed up. But if the car goes into neutral, it's like it doesn't matter if we've got our foot on the accelerator. It's like it doesn't speed up. It will slow down because the gears are no longer engaged. And so sometimes we have to learn that place where the mind can kind of be in neutral around a particular difficult pattern. That place is a place that we can learn to trust is not digging the rut deeper. And so this is a learning that we can begin to recognize. It's like, okay, can I be aware of this with the mind in neutral? And what does it feel like to be aware of a challenging habit or pattern with that quality of neutrality? What does that feel like? And one way that we can sometimes judge this or kind of taste this flavor is if it feels like the difficult state is not getting any stronger. Because if the gears are engaged and we're right buying into it, that pattern is going to strengthen. And so if it feels like it's not getting in any stronger, you've got some capacity to be with it in that neutral way. It may even feel sometimes like, you know, you're kind of in it with neutrality and then the gears are engaged and you see it whip up and then you go back to neutrality. So you begin to get a sense of the difference between what it feels like when the gears are engaged, when the mind is hooked to that pattern, and what it feels like when the mind is able to be with it without being hooked by it. And so we begin to learn. We begin to learn what that quality is, what it's like. And so what I'd say is that we sometimes have more capacity to have that place of neutrality than we give ourselves credit for. And so I often suggest, you know, try, even for 10 seconds to be with a pattern, like to see, can I know this? Can I be aware of this? And even if you stretch yourself for a few seconds beyond what you would normally do, that's encouraging you to recognize that place of non-engagement. It's encouraging your mind to begin to get familiar with what that feeling is like. And then if you choose to do something to step away from it, by all means, do that. So, you know, if you see the other piece, I'd say, and if you see trying to be mindful of something, you see it start to whip up, it's like that is not the time to try to be mindful of it. And so pick something else to pay attention to. Early in my practice, I did this a lot with the anger. There were certain times where I just couldn't be with it. And so often this seemed to be happening when I was walking. And so I would just redirect my attention. It's like, okay, yeah, there's that anger, and I'm just going to put my attention on my feet right now, not try to pay attention to that anger. So that's one thing that we can check into, you know, in terms of how do I know what to do? Can I be with this, or do I need to apply some kind of a tool? And another piece of this is the question that the person asked me a couple weeks ago. So is it clinging? Is it a problem if I am redirecting my attention? So as I said, you know, so sometimes we try to stay with something, but we redirect our attention. Is it a problem? Does it mean I'm doing that too soon? So again, what I'd say partly is the movement towards that redirection of attention. So like for me, when I chose to put my attention on my feet instead of paying attention to the anger, it was pretty clear that that was helpful. Because if I tried to pay attention to the anger, I would find myself, you know, 30 minutes later, not remembering where I was, having just spent the last half hour ruminating about that anger. So it's not helpful to try to be aware of the anger. And the turning the attention to the being with the feet, really let the mind let go. Help the mind to reorient. And so it was helpful. It was skillful to do that. So that's one of the questions you can check in. Is it creating more ease in the mind to pick up one of these tools and try to change the direction of the mind, as opposed to just being simply aware of the mind, of what's happening in the present moment? Does it feel like it supports a settling of the mind? And then the other piece around it is, at some point, you may begin to recognize the suffering, that there may be a little suffering in that choosing to pick up a redirection. So I have found at times that, like with the investigation, that habit created tightness in the mind. And that point was when I needed to work with, okay, that's the point when I need to start looking at letting go of that, even a wholesome state. So letting go of holding on to investigation. And so again, this teaching on by relying on this, abandon that, the Buddha in that teaching pointed to kind of the trajectory of the way that sutta unfolded. It's a long teaching. I don't want to go through the whole details of the teaching, but the basic flavor is that the kind of the trajectory or the arc of our practice starts by using wholesome states to help us let go of unwholesome states. And then, as those unwholesome states have let go, and the basic teaching there is, you know, by relying on the recognition of the impermanent nature of experience, we begin to let go of the ways we cling to sense pleasure, sense desire, the kind of ordinary ways we cling to the things in the world. That the recognition that things are impermanent, unreliable, helps us to let go of the way in which our mind feels like, well, there's going to be something permanent or reliable about this experience that'll let me land there, so I'll do that. The mind beginning to recognize, yeah, that doesn't actually work, because nothing is permanent or reliable enough to really land on. And so this kind of the wholesome understanding of impermanence helps us to let go of the habitual ways that we cling. And then he points to, well, there are even things like, you know, so then there's even things like some wholesome states that we cling to. And we may cling to rapture, exactly. Concentration. And that, he said, you know, so there's that cling. We may cling to those states. And then by relying on subtler kinds of wholesome states, so equanimity, we begin to be able to recognize there's a subtler kind of happiness with the way the mind can be balanced that lets us let go of the clinging to even some of these more pleasant wholesome states. And so he says, by relying on equanimity, one can let go of the clinging to things like rapture. And then he even further divided equanimity. He said, there are different kinds of equanimity. And by relying on this kind of equanimity, you can let go of that kind of equanimity. And so it gets very subtle. But the way he's pointing to is like, it's like stair steps. That we let go of the previous stair step by finding somewhere to land for now. But then we see that even that isn't a very solid or reliable place to land. And then there's another place that we can, by relying on the next thing, we let go of that. So he talks about the practice unfolding in this way. By relying on this, abandon that. And eventually, the last kind of step in this process is there's an understanding, basically the understanding that there isn't anything to rely on. And by relying on that understanding, the mind can let go of all its clinging, all its frustrations, all its patterns and habits of greed, aversion, delusion. So by relying on this, abandon that. And yet, you know, in this kind of, even the stair step kind of thing, it's nowhere near as neat as it sounds, you know. It's kind of like we jump around on the stairs. Sometimes it feels like we're in the place where we're, you know, really able to be present with experience, and there is this rapture and beautiful quality, and then we feel some of the subtlety of the suffering around that, and then suddenly we're back in aversion again. And then it can be useful. Okay, well, I'll maybe use the capacity of the mind to get concentrated again, to let this aversion settle, or maybe the capacity to meet the aversion just with, oh, this is what the experience of aversion is. Maybe that has grown so that you can allow the mindfulness and wisdom to grow through the understanding, through the kind of the disengagement of the gears. So in that disengagement of the gears, what seems to be happening is that the mind begins to really touch into or understand the nature of those difficult patterns and habits. So it begins to understand the nature of aversion. It begins to understand that it's not so useful. It begins to understand that aversion itself creates pain in the system. It begins to understand that the mind has been confused by aversion, thinking it was keeping me safe or keeping me happy in some way. And in the understanding that develops through meeting that experience in the disengaged kind of way, the mind gets a whole new perspective on these qualities and begins to let them go in a much more profound way. So those were the thoughts I had to share with you. By relying on this, abandon that. So there's a few minutes if there's any questions or comments, thoughts about what I've shared or anything. I'm happy to just see what's on your mind.
I really appreciate your wisdom, and something you shared today was very clear to understand and very helpful. And I always find your teachings to be very when you say well organized, or where, like, while I'm listening to you, there is a question. So as I go ahead listening to you, there is answer. So I really appreciate that. Mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm happy for the... Surely there's some questions, though. But thank you.
One question which was... like when you said that there is nothing to rely on, as Buddha mentioned, and there is a step you can step ahead, land on, and let go of the previous step.
Yeah.
So I was just curious where Buddha landed at the end, or did he land it anywhere, or he didn't land it?
So yeah, that's what that freedom is not very. It's more articulated in terms of what it's not than what it is. So the main kind of articulation that he described of that experience is greed, aversion, and delusion are not arising. They are absent from the mind. There's not much of a description of what is there. But without greed, aversion, delusion arising in the mind, there seems to be, I mean, some of the kind of side effects of that is that there seems to be at least kind of the unfolding of that seems to be a heart that is at ease, peaceful, not grasping after something or trying to get rid of something. No push-pull. So that's, again, the absence. There's an absence of a push-pull. There's an absence of a feeling of something needs to change. The mind can kind of just land in whatever is unfolding. No problem.
Without
greed, aversion, and delusion. Yeah, so that, you know, there's not a clear... There's a few similes that are offered, and he says it's a place of peace, of safety, of ease, but it's not safety in the way that we normally think of safety, which is I'm protected and I'm like, I have all my things around me to keep me safe. It's a safety of absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. You know, it's a safety of they're not feeling like there is something that needs to be protected. So it's hard for us to fathom in a way what that experiences or what that safety is. The flavor, at times I've had a flavor of something that might touch it or taste like it, something. It's this place where the mind just really, in a way it's kind of like what the talk I gave last week, neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. So there's just like, every single moment is new. Everything is different, but there's no like trying to hold on to the moment that's going away, no trying to move into the next moment that's coming. It's just like, oh, this is what's happening. And there's just a kind of an endless flow, an endless kind of resonance with this is what's happening. And there's no resistance and no holding on to this flow of experience. You know, Joseph Goldstein gave this analogy. This might be a good place to end this analogy. I think it's a kind of a fun pointing to that place when you said, where did he land or what is it? So Joseph talked about the practice being kind of like skydiving. You know, you go up in the airplane, and maybe it's your first time skydiving, and you know, maybe there's kind of an excitement, a nervousness of going up in the airplane, and then you get up there, and it's like, you know, the pilot says, okay, time to jump out, and you know, you're looking out the door, and it's kind of, you're holding on for dear life to the plane. It's like, I don't know that I want to jump out of this plane. But you got your backpack, you got your parachute on, and finally you let go of the plane, and you jump, and there's a kind of a falling, you know, and there's a kind of almost an exhilaration, as I hear that in the skydiving, I've never skydived, so, you know, but I hear as you hit the terminal velocity where you're no longer accelerating in the fall, but you hit this place where you're just kind of falling at a constant rate, it almost feels like you're floating. So that's what I understand that skydiving can feel like, is that it can feel at some point that you're like you're floating. And then there's a kind of a beautiful experience in that place. And then, so some of the meditation can be like that, you know, that, you know, initially it's like you're running up against all of these resistances and all of these things you don't want to let go of and holding on to, and then you finally can let go of them and you jump out and it's like you find your way to some rapture and some nice states of concentration, and there you are kind of floating in that place. And then in Joseph's analogy, he says, you realize that you've not got your parachute on. And the mind is kind of like knowing that it's going to hit the ground, and there's all this fear of the pain of the landing, you know, on the ground. And so you go through that kind of stage. And there's a stage in meditation where there's kind of this sense of, you know, it's almost like there's this sense of all of the ways and the strategies that I've used, that I've been familiar with, they're not working anymore. And there's nothing else that I've got. And it feels like it's going to be a big mess. It's like the mind has not quite shifted to nowhere to land, you know. It's still holding on to all of its habits of how it navigated before. And so that's the place where you realize, I don't have my old habits. I don't have that parachute anymore. But I don't know what the next, what it is, and I can only envision a big mess when I go kersplat on the ground. And then Joseph says, you realize that there actually is no ground to land on. That there is only an endless free fall. And that is kind of the nature of that aligning ourselves with just this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. There's nowhere to land. There's no place to say, this experience, I'm landing here and that's where I'm going to be happy. That's where I can like stake my claim and say, I'm going to hold on to that. Because that very holding on to something that we think is going to make us happy is, that very holding on is painful. And so as we begin to see that we let go, like there's nothing to pick up. There actually isn't anything to pick up. And there's nothing to let go of. There's just this endless flow of experience. Nowhere to land, nothing to resist, nothing to hold on to. It's kind of got that flavor. There's no ground, endless free fall. That may either sound appealing or not, depending on your...
Yes.
It's scary and exciting.
Exactly.
It does help me to understand with that particular analogy. Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you. And It's time to stop, so thank you.